exploring the cultures of consciousness. This year, 2014, is the 50th anniversary of a book that I find endlessly fascinating, the book being The Psychedelic Experience, written, put together by Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, later Ram Dass, and our guest today, Ralph Metzner. And I was already hoping to interview Ralph simply because of the anniversary. The Psychedelic Experience is a book that's both forgotten and remembered in the history of psychedelic literature. In some ways, it's very much a product of its time, as it attempts to use the model of the Bardo states found in the Tibetan Book of the Dead as a way to model and understand and help organize the phantasmagoria of the LSD experience. And in some ways, our metaphors and understanding of the relationship between religious experience and psychedelics and the appropriateness of Tibetan models, even in contrast to a shamanic understanding, all these things have changed tremendously in 50 years. And yet, I think there's a brilliance to that book that sometimes is not recognized, even though in some ways it's again like the Oracle newspaper or the first Jimi Hendrix record. It's very much a product of the 1960s. But I also think shows how important a sort of nitty gritty sense of the structuring and informed understanding of different mythologies and different religious systems are in the attempt to make sense, to organize, to extract the greatest light and the greatest heat from the psychedelic experience. So I'm really happy that Ralph agreed to talk to us, but even more fun is that there's a much fresher reason for our conversation today, which is the publication of his new book, The Toad and the Jaguar. And Ralph's been very prolific over the years. He's written many, many books, The Well of Remembrance, Green Psychology, Birth of a Psychedelic Culture, which is interesting along the lines of talking about that very early period at Harvard. But this new book, The Toad and the Jaguar, is particularly special, I would say. And in this foreword, Stan Groff talks about it as definitely being is going to be seen as a classic, and I highly agree. It's a slim volume, and what makes it special is that it's about a very special compound, 5-MeO-DMT. People talk about DMT, but there's really two main intensely psychedelic DMTs. NN-DMT, which is usually what people are talking about, but there's also 5-MeO-DMT. And there was something very special about 5-MeO-DMT, 5-methoxy-DMT, which is that it was not scheduled by the U.S. government until 2011, until just a few years ago. It was available legally. There was no opprobrium around it. And so it became a kind of, well, a sort of esoteric substance in the community, because people who were interested in exploring the therapeutic, psychological, and spiritual dimensions of psychedelics had access to a very powerful, very profound compound that was not scheduled. And so what this led to was an underground world of groups and therapists, including Ralph, who were working very diligently with this substance, taking notes and organizing protocols and really approaching it as scientists, as therapists of the soul, legitimately. And then for reasons perhaps we'll talk about, I'm not sure what Ralph thinks about it, it was scheduled, and so now it's in the same ball game with all the other fascinating, problematic, potentially spiritual, compounds that are out there in the politics of the drug war. And so What Ralph did was basically write up his lab notes, give us his vision, the wisdom that he accrued through these very concrete, very hands-on, very grounded descriptions of the experiences, different possibilities, different ways that people have integrated this powerful substance into their lives. So it's a very very handy kind of book, and it's a remarkable glimpse of what psychedelic research could be like, has been like, is like in some regards, in terms of balancing the claims of therapy, of psychotherapy, of a scientific model with a deeper, more spiritual kind of dimension. So it's a fascinating book, and I'm really glad that Ralph made time to talk to us today. So, but before we bring on Dr. Metzner, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
One of the things we're going to talk about is that 5-MeO-DMT occurs naturally in the world, not only from plants, which is where, you know, the vast majority of our psychedelics come from, although there are some psychedelic fish out there, but 5-MeO is associated with the toad.
Yep.
The toad, Bufo alvarius, a toad that you can find even in the Sonoran Desert here in the United States. And I was wondering, can you give me some mythological data download on the sort of mythological associations of the toad? I mean, there's something striking that this remarkable substance, possibly the most spiritual of the psychedelics, is excreted naturally by a toad.
Yeah, it is, and I've thought about it a lot. That's actually how I found out about DMT. It was while I was, I think I was 19 or 20. I was researching because I had just seen that documentary on the cane toads. I don't know if you ever saw that documentary, but it's hilarious.
Very
how
funny.
They introduced them. Yeah. So I saw that, and I was researching all this stuff on toads, and I came across this toad that had DMT in it. And I was like, what? Because I had never heard of it before or that even that had existed. And I'm one of those people that spend a lot of time thinking about, like, why do plants have this chemical in it in the first place? You know, like, what's the consciousness of the organism that's containing these chemicals that don't even have brains? And then I thought about it, like, in terms of animals with the toad. Like, what does that mean that this animal contains this substance? And then, like, you look at toads mythologically, like you said, archetypally throughout fairy tales, and they always represent transformation. I mean, here a toad is this thing, this creature that goes from, you know, living in the water and having gills and breathing water to actually attaining evolution in its lifetime, so to speak. Like, if you look at the life of the toad, right, without sounding crazy, you can see how it's like a microcosmic biological representation of the act of evolving out of the water and onto the land. So
that's,
I think,
great.
That's like a big thing for why they, I think, mythologically have those kind of symbolic connotations of making these evolutionary steps, because they kind of do it biologically.
Wonderful. Well, great. With that, let's bring on Ralph to the show. Ralph, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Can you speak up a little bit? Sometimes the sound's a little bad.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. How's that?
Oh, wonderful. Thank
okay.
you. So I noticed in the beginning of the toad and the jaguar, there's a wonderful picture of you working with a fellow researcher to try to extract the toad venom from the toad. And I thought that might be a fun place to start out, is just talking about your own experience working with the animal and your impression of the animal and the place you were when that went down.
Well, I wanted to explore that avenue or that source of 5-MeO-DMT, which I had actually previously experienced ingesting as a synthetic substance, so I was predisposed towards being interested in it. And I want to just add that I do not in the book, and I do not personally recommend that people go looking for that toad and squeezing the venom out of it. And so the toad is an endangered, it's a threatened species. It's toads and frogs and amphibians worldwide are in decline and in retreat, and this work that we did was in the 60s, and things have gotten much worse since then, and it's not necessary to do it, and I think the toads should be left alone, actually. The way we had for harvesting it was you know, didn't harm them, doesn't harm them. They're released and back into nature, and it was just part of the research we wanted to do to establish that this particular toad was the one, because there was also internet rumors about a different toad, and you know, there was some dispute about which particular toad species was used, and there's some cultural allusions in Mayan culture that toads were regarded as sacred.
Well, that was one question I had about the, I know that in South America there are some 5-MeO-DMT that's inside of plant substances, and particularly the hallucinogenic snuffs that are used by a number of tribes. But is there any ethnographic allusions or suggestions that the toad venom was ever used in ritual or sacred ceremonies?
There have been a couple, no. Basically, no. There's been a couple of people, one or two people, who tried to find something.
Somehow that you got quiet again.
What, apart from pictures?
Rob, can you speak up again? Because I can't.
I'm sorry.
The sound became very quiet. I'm wondering if the phone would.
I'm talking right into it.
Okay. So there's no real evidence for that. Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. I wonder how it was ever even discovered, but I'm curious because you do also work on the archetypal dimension of nature, on the sort of place where mythology.
Well, let me go back to the toad. Ecologically, the venom is a defensive venom for the toad. That's how it evolved. I describe in the book how we observed some of the species of toads in Arizona hanging around somebody's swimming pool. And when the dog comes and attacks them and bites into them, it bites into the gland that has the toad. They get a squirt of the toad into their gums or their eyes or gums, basically, and then they flip out, you know, psychically. And the dog is kind of lies on the ground as if dead. He's not dead. His tongue is lolling out, his eyes are rolled back in his head. And after about half an hour, he gets up and walks away. But he's clearly forgotten all about the toad that he was about to attack. So it's a defensive maneuver, and that's how it evolved. Now, the fact that it, you know, that same substance secreted by the toad can also, when ingested by humans, and by the way, one should not take the toad venom as a direct snuff. It can only be taken, the toad venom, as a smoke. Because the toad venom might have other venomous things in it besides 5-MeO-DMT. But anyway, so it's a kind of an evolutionary puzzle why the toad would have evolved a defensive maneuver that happens to produce you know, consciousness expanding experience in humans. So there it is.
Yeah, no, it's a remarkable one of those mysterious conundrums that lie in natural history. I'm curious, since you had you know, experience and interest in so many different substances going back to the 1960s, when things were much more open in terms of being able to explore and research. What was it about the experiential side of this that intrigued you from over the years?
What was it about what?
What the experiential, the subjective experience of 5-MeO. What is it that intrigued you about that?
Well, actually, I became aware of it at the same time as I became aware of DMT, and then it was much more interesting to research because it was not socially dangerous and didn't have consequences of being busted and so forth, social consequences that are, so, and the fact that it was, and I mentioned this in the book, the fact that there may have been like a silent kind of conspiracy not to publish information about 5-MeO-DMT in the scientific journals. I speculate that's about it. I don't know for sure, but because it was kept quiet, whereas DMT became notorious and was made illegal in 1969, just along with everything else. But somehow that one wasn't made illegal. It never became part of the underground. And DMT acquired this kind of mystique as being the most powerful hallucinogen, which it's not. Because there's a difference between the power of a drug and the potency of a drug. The power of a drug is how far, how deep the experience can be. The potency is how little of a substance you need to get to that same deep space. So mescaline and LSD, for example, and DMT are all equally powerful, but they differ greatly in potency because the amount that's needed differs greatly. And that's one of the big differences between 5-MeO-DMT and DMT, which is, you know, some people regard as a kind of a holy grail. And to me, that reputation is undeserved. Because when DMT is ingested by humans as a smoke, you know, it lasts about 3 minutes. And there's not very much research you can do in 3 minutes. And 5-MeO-DMT, when smoked, lasts about 15 minutes, which is a little better. But the crucial difference comes in when you snuff it. And you can't, because when you... If you could snuff DMT, well, of course, DMT can be injected, and it was, in fact, injected by intramuscular injection in the studies by Rick Strassman that he did on DMT.
Yes.
That's a whole other story. I mean, then I'm not talking about underground, you know, because... when DMT is... when 5-MeO-DMT is taken as a snuff, then it lasts about an hour, and it has this plant ancestry because, you know, it was used by several different tribes in the plant form. But you can't snuff DMT because the DMT dosage is 60 milligram, whereas an effective dose of 5-MeO-DMT is like 10 milligrams, so, or less, so that's about 10 times as potent. The 5-MeO is 10 times as potent. You need much less. You can't snuff a dose of DMT. It would burn your nostrils. People have not done it, and rightly so. Even to smoke it, you have to inhale about 3 or 4 big lungfuls before you get the effect.
And wasn't that insight, which is one of the big points that you make in the book, and you talk about particularly how 5-MeO is sometimes associated with very, very terrifying experiences, and Stan Grof himself, you know, certainly an experienced fellow, describes his own very difficult encounter with smoked 5-MeO, and one of the points you're making here is that the insufflation method also tends to be a gentler powerful experience.
Right, it's too easy to ingest a dose that's too high. You see, one of the main points I want to make, and I continue to make, is that we have to break the set that a higher dose is almost always leads to a more profound experience. That's an ancient Paracelsus principle back in the 16th century that he formulated. The optimal dose is between not enough and too much. The difference, Paracelsus said, the difference between the poison and the medicine is the dosage. The same medicine that can be healing and at one level is a poison at another level and toxic. So it's a inverted U-shaped curve. And a lot of people, myself included, you know, we're all caught, and a lot of people to this day in the underground still think that higher dose is automatically better. It's totally not true, and in fact dangerously not true. And in the case of 5-MeO, the difference, what I say is you want to find the difference between the effective dose and the dissociative dose. I mean, the high doses are not, they're not lethal, they don't kill you, but they lead to dissociated states where you basically don't remember anything. You pass out, basically. You lose consciousness and you lose contact with reality, and then you come back. And then you can see those examples of those accounts in Shulgin's book, you know, and people say, well, I took this drug and, you know, then the next thing I knew, I looked at my watch and 15 minutes had passed or 20 minutes had passed. I remember nothing, you see. And to me, those kinds of experiences are not really useful because you don't learn anything from them.
Well,
so
what
anyway,
about
so
people that will, what about some people who will have those experiences and, you know, they'll be out for like 3 minutes or whatever, but then when they come back, they do remember everything, because I've certainly talked to individuals
remember
that...
remember some things, yeah, they remember some things.
Or a lot, yeah,
but
it
not
seems
everything.
Like there was a kind
you,
of
they don't know
whether
they remember anything. You don't remember, you don't know, learn anything from a dream that you don't remember, so...
Right.
You only... Learn something from that part that you do remember. So that's typically, more typically what happens is that,
right.
You know, people go out and then when they come back, then they're, you know, they remember a few things and that's kind of very interesting. So what I'm trying to establish in the book is that, you know, for serious investigative work, I mean, people can do what they want to and will do what they want to anyway and might say, well, it was great to, you know, to go out and but for research to something to that you can share and describe, you know, you want to be able to find a dose that's enough to sort of stretch your boundaries, but
right.
Not so far that you can't talk about it. You can't communicate it. See, if you can't communicate it, it's not science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Science is a network of communication. You might feel good, and that's good in itself. That's a value to feel good. But if you can't communicate it, it doesn't add to the shared knowledge base of science.
Right. And I think it's even there's even a personal side, less about the science. Though what you're saying makes perfect sense. If you can't articulate something about it and build a general map through the articulations, it's not really going to help. With the science, but I think it's also not always the case. I mean, what Maj said I think is true for a lot of people, but I think it's often the case that it's more easy to integrate personally or psychologically experiences that are subtler. I think that's true with all compounds. So I think on this show before we've talked about this whole idea of subtle allies, that there are allies that are mighty and swallow you up, and there are allies that are subtle and friendly, and that there's a whole range of experiences in between that, like you say, is not enough a part, certainly of the of the underground. But we haven't really talked very much about what is specific about the 5-MeO state that or set, you know, ranges of experiences associated with it that seem well, particularly interesting, even in the, you know, the fascinating world of psychedelic molecules of LSD and ketamine and peyote, and there's, you know, a lot of marvelous, fascinating compounds. There seems to me something particularly interesting in the accounts that people give, something even more spiritual, if one might say that, something transcendental, something very, very pure and of the heart. I would love to hear you reflect a little bit about what was particular about this substance that made you so interested in it, and as you observed many people over the years.
I lean more towards the other side of the spectrum of those. I think there are some, you know, some slight differences between the different drugs, but to me the experience. The idea that you approach it from the point of view of the physical effects, the emotional and mental psychological effects, and then the spiritual effects, which are actually not effects, but, you know, spirit is the core essence of everything. So the experiences can be a mix of spiritual, emotional, heart connections, and mental insights and understandings, and physical healing effects, all depending on the set and the setting. As always, the set and the setting are the key factors that that determine the experience. And then the particular medicine that you take, whether it's a plant or a fungus or animal derived or from wherever, also plays a role, more like the role of a kind of a catalyst. So, in the book, I've collected dozens. I mean, the ones that I published are, of course, the most interesting ones. And, you know, I had about 10 times as many accounts from people that I collected who had more, you know, ordinary level experiences of psychological insights, of healing problems, problem solving, depending on what, you know, the set and setting were going on at the same time. So, but I think from the point of view of the society and the research, medical, scientific, psychological research, this substance is particularly interesting. I mean, MDMA is also very interesting because it has a whole other sort of range of effects. But the DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, are tryptamines like LSD, and so they're classic experiences that cover, you know, that whole spectrum. I think MDMA is in a different class. I mean, you can also have psychedelic effects, but because of the visual and mental, the visual effects are minimal to non-existent, and the primary effect of MDMA is heart-opening, kind of empathic. I call them empathogenic effect. It's much more useful than therapy, for example. I don't see that much value. I should take that back. I think 5-MeO does have value in therapy because of the fact that it's only only lasts about an hour, you know, which is manageable, especially in a controlled therapeutic setting, because certainly much more than LSD, because LSD typically might last 6 to 8 hours, and even ecstasy or MDMA, which is a valuable therapy drug, lasts, you know, about 3 to 4 hours, and usually people have to go into stay in a hospital and overnight and so forth.
Interesting.
So there's differences whether you're talking about it as a recreational drug or whether you're talking about it as a medical, scientific research or therapy drug.
But, and from your perspective, in terms of therapy, which I would also include sort of, you know, spiritual exploration as part in a therapeutic rather than a recreational model, that the specific substances in the end matter less to you than the set and setting, then the mind frame, then the intentionality, then the structure of the experience.
Yes, they matter some, but you know, and I mentioned a couple of points in the book where I think it would be worth to do some more specific research on these issues on the because the effect on the neuromuscular junction, where you have this incredibly enhanced kind of sensory motor flexibility when people make movements with their hands. Or with their feet or any of their limbs, even slight movement, there's this, people report this kind of very silky kind of feeling as if all the joints had been kind of lubricated from inside with this incredibly smooth, silky thing, and people can get into yoga postures, for example, that they ordinarily can't get into, except with like strain and stress and tension. And it's a drug-related effect because, it, you know, there's some kind of neurotransmitter that's at the neuromuscular junction. And I think that could be like a specific thing in my project that could be pursued for, you know, illnesses that involve neuromuscular coordination like that.
And you find that those effects seem to be particularly associated with 5-MeO.
So far, yeah. I haven't noticed it. As far as I know, it's not been reported in the literature about LSD and psilocybin. I mean, it might be there present as well, but and the fact that that the action is so short, you see, that makes it also useful because psychiatric research, medical researchers don't, you know. It's difficult to integrate, which of course presently can't be done anyway because it's illegal. It's only done, you know, in very restricted circumstances, you know. And there are some projects that have been approved and are legally done using MDMA in the treatment of trauma, as we know. But it's not available as a therapy for trauma. You can't get a prescription if you're traumatized, and a doctor can't prescribe it. You know, it can only be used in a research project.
Right. It seems kind of silly. So is there currently any studies on 5-MeO-DMT that you're aware of that are looking towards searching for
using it? Well, it was actually part of my intention to by putting out this book and pointing out that it's, you know, short acting and not toxic, and there's this big literature and there's these very, very promising things. So that's part of the intention, I think. I asked Rick Doblin, and he said, "I think there's one study currently being considered." You know, but like when you look at the social, political, well, let's say social, you know, aspect of these drugs, it's always like this big kind of paradoxical disconnect. You know, there's a very small number of psychiatric researchers who may be exploring one or another very specific project for which they have to raise all the money themselves, and there's absolutely zero government or, you know, public scientific support for it. And it's extremely laborious, as the people, you know, from the MAPS organization probably have to do. And then there's a vast underground that maybe, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times as many people use the substance. There's no way of knowing how many people use F5-MeO. There's no way of knowing. People have estimated the number of people. Like, I once was in a conference, you know, where people talked about MDMA, and Jim Fadiman asked, well, how many people have experienced MDMA, you know, in the context of a scientific research project, and about half a dozen people raised their hand. And then he said, of all, there was like 2,500 people in the audience. Then he said, how many people have experienced MDMA? And everybody raised their hand. Now, what is that, you see? That to me is like very interesting. It's not about the drug. It's about the society that we live in and the kind of legal social system that we have that regulates drugs and controls drugs.
As you mentioned, the entire society is, or not the entire, but many in the society are participating regardless of the societal structure that's placed upon them. So I don't even know if it's society, but it's that weird, like, paradigmatic structure that's placed on top of it.
Yeah, well, it's the political, you know, the social, the medical pharmaceutical complex, the military industrial medical pharmaceutical complex. Military-industrial medical pharmaceutical prison complex.
That's it. It's one big monstrous octopus. But listen, we have to take a break right now, very short. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We have the great pleasure of speaking with Ralph Metzner, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here talking with Eric Davis, and today we're speaking with Ralph Metzner, and we're talking about DMT. So weird on this show, that never happens. But before the break, you brought up such an important point of this structure that's placed upon it, and I feel like for someone like you to write a book like that and put it out with that intention, I think that's very courageous and necessary to try to break through these things. And I wonder, have you personally, like, received flack for it, or how do people react to you? Do you find that people are understanding after they read the book and can see your logic, or do you feel like they still continue to be weird about it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what people think about it.
So they don't like confront you about it.
Confront me about it?
Yeah, like, you know, give you flack or give you negative reviews when you
Why bring it up. No, I haven't.
I hope you don't.
I would think people that don't have a negative opinion about it probably wouldn't buy it and wouldn't read it, and I wouldn't know about it. See, I'm not a drug advocate. I don't advocate the drug, and I'm reporting on research that was done, and my model as a researcher is a participant observer. It's an ethnographic model, which is the standard model. It's not, they're not reporting double blind placebo controlled studies. That's totally inappropriate for this substance or any other such psychedelic substance, because they are not about to be introduced into the medical pharmaceutical market. This is pre all of that. This is like, you know, explorers exploring the use of certain plants and mushrooms in various cultures, and this happens to be Western mainstream culture. But the mainstream culture doesn't use these things. It's an underground mainstream culture, underground of the mainstream. So the mainstream culture regards these as toxic poisons or, you know, esoteric medicines that can be researched in some way. And there are some medically approved research projects going on in these areas which are worthwhile, definitely. And And then there's a vast underground uses of there's a very large underground uses of recreational drug users, but even apart from that, I'm not talking about those, people that take these drugs like DMT and so forth, LMAs, and go dancing with music and like MDMA, the same thing. The same drug, see, that's being used in the therapy of veterans, is being used by people to dance ecstasy. But it's not healing any traumas there. They're just dancing, you see. It all depends on the set and the setting. That's what Leary said. The set and the setting, the intention that you bring to it, and the context that you create.
So here, I have a question on
recreational. Then there's, you know, the underground of people, the serious people that want to use for where the intention is healing and therapeutic, personal healing and creativity enhancement and spiritual growth. So those are that's the segment of the underground that I'm communicating with.
Well, one of the interesting things about your work is that, you know, you come from a scientific background. You work within a scientific framework in the way that you're talking about. You know, slightly different, not double blind, but you're still approaching it as a researcher, as a participant observer, as an ethnographer in a sense.
Yeah.
And when you talk about the different levels of healing or action that these substances can help can produce in people, there's the physical level, there's emotional level, there's a cognitive insight level. All of those are easy enough to assimilate into a scientific framework. But of course, once you hit the level of spirituality,
right,
it becomes more complicated.
Yes.
And I would just love to hear you talk about how you, as a researcher, as someone who's approaching these things in a generally scientific frame of mind, how you think about that spiritual dimension as opposed to a emotional or cognitive dimension.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's linked, but...
Yeah, see, that gets us into questions of history and scientific paradigm. You know, we as a society, Western society, is stuck with a scientific paradigm that regards the spiritual dimensions as taboo, basically, off limits. And that's a hangover. That's a historical hangover from the 16th century, where people who were forbidden, you know, the Catholic Church was a dominant political institution and had the power of force and violence called the Inquisition to put people in jail who made said anything about spirit or God or the divine or higher consciousness or anything like that. And so that, you know, we're no longer ruled by the Catholic Church paradigm of the Middle Ages. But in fact, the mindset is still the same. Spirituality is off limits for science, except for individual scientists, of course, you know, and the whole area of consciousness, you know, even altered states of consciousness, which is sort of the area that I came out of, you know, came from in terms of Harvard University psychology research or altered states of consciousness. But, you know, you don't talk about spiritual being, because that's people get scared when you talk about spirituality. So then psychologists developed this concept of the transpersonal, you know, the dimensions of reality that go beyond mind and feelings and body. And that is growing. That is a kind of a paradigm, you might say, that is slowly gaining ground, but not in the mainstream psychology. You won't see that in American Psychological Association. It's a subculture even within the mainstream scientific culture, you see.
Do you feel like there's a correlation between the scientific attitude towards experimenting and finding out more about psychedelics and the way that they look at spirituality?
Say the question again.
So do you think there's like a relationship for the stigmata that scientists place upon these psychedelic substances and researching them in kind of the same way? Is it like a similar attitude as the way they look at spirituality? Do you think it's more
connected? Well, depends who you're talking to, of course.
Right.
There are scientists, you know, individual scientists and people like Stan Grof and many others and within the medical sciences, the psychological science, social sciences, and even some physical scientists and so forth that have a greater openness to this area of research. and the area of, you know, altered states of consciousness or states, differing states of consciousness, which includes not only drug-induced states, but also mystical experiences, for example, and near-death experiences, and experiences of prenatal experiences, and, you know, reincarnational memories, and those kinds of things. So I'm my overall paradigm, as which I think is shared by most of the researchers in this field, is the William James paradigm of radical empiricism, which is also the paradigm of the Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama and other Buddhist teachers are now recognizing that they want to collaborate with Western scientists and use a scientific approach to. But Western science has to recognize that what the Dalai Lama calls first-person empiricism, which is the person's own experiences, should also be included. You don't just study, you know, the experience in somebody else.
Right.
And when we were doing the studies at Harvard, Harvard University said, "No, well, you can't take that drug yourself. That's not scientific. You have to observe other people." And Leary used to say quite rightly, "Well, there's nothing to observe. The person's just lying on the ground every now and again for hours, and every now and then it says, 'Wow, that's amazing.'" So there's no behavior. So if you want to know what's going on, you have to actually take the thing yourself. But science, you know, mainstream science freaks out when they hear that.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how this is going to change, or whether it doesn't really change, whether people who are also scientists who are working on this material, including, let's say, you know, neuroscientists who are interested in the phenomenology of meditation or are working with monks, as psychedelic research increases, whether there will be a kind of shift or a sort of war of paradigms, or whether it will just continue with a sort of mainstream, materialistic, pharmacology-dominated model of psychology, and then this sort of subculture, like you say, of people who are trying to break down that distinction.
I think that's right. That's the way it goes. I don't think it's necessarily a war of paradigms. It's just like the paradigm gradually crumbles at the edges, and there are individual scientists who are brave enough and, you know, persistent enough. I mean, look at the guy who's doing the medical research. He's been trying for 17 years to get official permission from the government to study the medical effects of the healing effects of cannabis, and he can't get the license, and he's a doctor and everything like that. But, you know, it continues, and people do the research anyway, and, you know, do the best they can, and there are some studies that have been done, some amazing studies that Charlie Grobe and others have done, and for example, in the applications, I think, of psychedelic substances like LSD in helping prepare people for dying. We know when it's given to people who have been given a terminal diagnosis, and that's a little bit of an opening of the Western medical paradigm, where they've been given a diagnosis, well, you're going to die within the next 4 months, so there's nothing we can do for you, but, you know, if this substance can help you, we're going to look into whether this substance can help you have a more positive attitude towards dying with less fear. And that's a kind of a minor breakthrough as far as the sort of medical pharmaceutical control paradigm, because there's no pretense that it's going to cure anything, you see.
To me that's the most hopeful of all the research. I find that the most positive in that side.
I'm curious. Why in the book, I told the Jaguar, I mentioned these, you know, specific possible positive effects on the fluidity of the neuromuscular junction might be like a specific research project that one could do. Now, that's not going to test. You can't scientifically test whether a drug produces a mystical experience. That's mixing your paradigms. You know, science. It's not up to science to validate mysticism. It's not its job. It should just stop trying to pretend to do that, and talk about God. Think about God molecules, I think, is disrespectful. And science just should just concentrate on what they do best, which is establish facts and paradigms, and use William James's paradigm, is which that you don't exclude any experience just because you can't explain it yet. You see, that's not science. That's a radical empiricism. If you base all your speculations, all your theories on empirical observations, and you don't exclude any possible paradigms just because any possible observations just because your paradigm doesn't accommodate them.
Yeah.
That's called radical empiricism. So you wouldn't exclude, you know, parapsychological, but parapsychology, for example, is still excluded from mainstream social science. And the people, even although the data have been, you know, around for 100 years of ESP and, you know, all those other experiences, not to mention near-death experiences. Near-death experiences give scientists like paroxysms of denial and, you know, explaining it away.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. Hey, I also wanted to, you know, as we're reaching the last 10 minutes or so here, the title of your book is The Toad and the Jaguar, and we didn't mention the jaguar, and I'm curious just to why you gave the synthetic form of the substance that name. What is it about the jaguar that you wanted to...
Well, that was just a code name that came up. I tell the story somewhere in the book that was a code name that a group of people that I knew or know and adopted for it when they were doing the initially some people were experimenting with DMT in combination with 5-MeO-DMT and you know as a smoke or then later on as a snuff, and the suddenness of the effect, especially when it's taken as a smoke. You know, because when it's taken as a smoke, it kind of, you know, it can happen that you're still holding the pipe, and like in that account that was related by Stan Grof, you're still holding the pipe, and all of a sudden you're completely in a different world. So there's a suddenness of it, that like in Maya iconography, you see this image of the jaguar as a shamanic animal that. You know, it's the suddenness of a predator's attack that, you know, engulfs the person in a non-ego, non-identity, a sudden near-death experience.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too, just because jaguars actually physically in the wild have been on record as eating plants with DMT specifically,
yeah.
Or what seems like on purpose. I always think it's funny that jaguars get affiliated with that plant because they actually partake of it.
Yes, DMT is all over the place, and other things as well, all over the plant kingdom. You know, I think the speculations of people like Dennis McKenna and others that the DMT-like plants, DMT-containing plants and fungi, are extremely widespread. And animals, right down to animals like marine animals, marine invertebrates, for Pete's sake, evolutionarily very, very old, and have psychoactive chemicals in their bodies. But we don't get the psychoactive chemicals anymore because, our environment has become so polluted and our foodstuffs have become so polluted. So these more subtle dimensions of naturally mind-expanding in cannabis, the endocannabinoids, right? Endocannabinoids have been found all over the place, in all kinds of animals, all up and down the evolutionary scale. And maybe endopsychedelics will be found as well. Endotryptamines.
Totally.
And, because through evolution and, you know, all the other mixing of toxins and toxic environments, so of course they're not... So some people, that's why some people think about cannabis, right? Maybe the cannabis plant kind of restores the connection and re-strengthens the endogenous cannabinoids that people have used as an appetite stimulant, because it has all this whole range of medical healing effects, you see, that are built in. Immune is part of the endocannabinoid system is part of the immune system. So it evolved to have all these immune system stimulating effects. But it evolved, and then further layers of social, cultural, and toxicity, environmental toxicity, kind of blocked it out.
Well, it's funny, you're already sort of answering my kind of last question here. You've been writing a whole series of books on the ecology of consciousness, and,
right.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about the role that you see these substances playing in a shift into a recognition of our reality as beings embedded in an ecology and also in an ecology that is very traumatized right now. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about that ecology of consciousness side of your work.
Yeah, well, you're going to give me 3 minutes to summarize.
I'm sorry, that's how it goes.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, it's in those seven books, I tried to relate, you know, everything that I've learned from my explorations of consciousness over the last 30, 40 years, which is kind of absurd in a way. But I also wanted to try to summarize them in a relatively short time, short term. Each book is relatively short, like 100 pages plus or minus, because I kind of recognize that nowadays people don't, are not likely to read books of 400 or 500 pages. Certainly I'm not myself. So I wanted to kind of summarize the essence, what I thought of the essence, rather than giving all the detailed proofs and detailed you know, footnotes and all of that. I mean, there are footnotes, but so anyway, and it's not necessarily a sequence, but it covers the different aspects. So there's one book called Mind Space and Time Stream, which looks specifically at the paradigm of different states of consciousness. And because each state of consciousness that we're in has its own time and its own space. Like, you think about the dream state and how different it is from the waking state, right? In a dream sleep state, which is a very common state, we have it every night, whether we take a drug or not. And you can, you know, time and space are completely different. You can go and visit your grandmother who lives 2,000 miles away. It doesn't take you any time whatsoever to visit her. You're as close as you feel. Right, distance and not geographical, but emotional or relational, and you could visit other countries and like that. So and drug experiences, like with these consciousness expanding drugs, that's one of the main changes, is that it changes your sense of time and space. That's what people have always said. That's why in DMT or 5-MeO-DMT, people can have, you know, visions of the entire spectrum of human evolution. And but the same is true of near-death experiences, for example, without any drugs. And people can have these complex experiences that would take hundreds of pages to write and describe, and then they come back and they look at their watch and they say, well, 5 minutes have passed.
Yeah.
So each state of consciousness has its own time and space parameters. And so that's what I, you know, that's what I try to establish, and that's, that means then you have to include the subjective experience, the person's subjective experience. The subjective realm is equally valid as a source of observations as the objective realm. And you can make objective observations in the subjective realms of consciousness. That's what you're doing. When people report on their dreams or their experiences of meditation and they compare them with each other and they say, you know, Jung did that. Jung would say, he would say, a patient would come in and would say, well, I had this weird dream where there was this green man and da-da-da, and there was a red woman and da-da-da. And he said, that's interesting. And he'd go to a book on his shelf and pull out a picture that was made in the 16th century in some alchemical text, and he said, just like that, huh? And the person would say, yes, just like that. Where did you find that? You see, so that meant to the person, that was very important for the person, because if you have an experience that only you have, that nobody else has ever had before, you might think, well, I'm really going crazy now, this is it, this takes the cake. But if you have one other person who could say, yeah, I had that, you know, or maybe, ideally, maybe even two or three other people who said, yeah, I had that similar thing, I know what you mean. See, that's a completely different thing. That's what's called empiricism. The objective is the subjective plus one. As soon as you have subjective experience, you don't know whether it's real or not. But if you have one other person who can say, yeah, I know what you mean, I saw the same thing. And then if you have two or three or 10 or 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000, that's even better, you see.
Yeah. So it's like that gives us a great encouragement to not only explore experience, but to articulate it and to appreciate other people's articulations,
yes,
including the articulations of the path of mythology of different religious systems.
Right. Describe your experience and to share it with others and compare notes, you see. You both went to the Amazon jungle and you compare notes. Some of you saw the trees, some of you saw the birds, and you want to compare notes. And that's what science is. That to me is what true science is.
Well, wonderful. We're going to have to end on that note. It was a great conversation, Ralph. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. It was great talking with Ralph Metzer's new book, The Toad and the Jaguar, highly recommended, as is his recent Ecology of Consciousness series. Oh, yes. What's your website, Ralph?
greenearthfound.org.
That's right.
Greenearthfound.org.
Greenearthfound.org. Okay, from Eric and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.